Chapter 30. Dear Ma, it's Mother's Day here at the club. We helped 160 servicemen write letters home today, and now we're writing our own. So much has happened over the last 2 months. The night we got here, we were called to the station to help feed the refugees coming through. Just a big freight shed, 2 smoking stoves, cases of unopened and unlabeled supplies, thousands upon thousands of wretched old men and women and children and invalids crowding in, and a cluster of exhausted Smith women rushing about diluting milk and desperately trying to find cups and bowls enough to serve everyone. After a night of that, we came up with a system of 8-hour shifts and got in some more stoves and supplies, so we had that all pretty well up and running within 3 days. With every train of evacuees that leaves the station, we try to make sure each person has a packet containing a can of meat or sardines, bread, chocolate, and a can of condensed milk. We'd just got that in order when one night a doctor came to our door asking if we could give his blessé something to eat. So off we went, and the next thing we knew, we were in the business of providing hot milk and soup and cigarettes to the trains of wounded that go by. They try to put the English-speaking men together, so we gather up all the daily papers in English we can for them. Our own boys were so happy to see American faces again that one thing led to another, and now, on top of it all, we've been doing hospital visits, taking writing materials and treats to our boys, and have made a sort of club for the men where they can come as they convalesce, with a parlor and a reading room and sing-alongs for the boys 2 nights a week. It's become a general theory around here that if they can survive Dr. Clare singing Gilbert and Sullivan at them, they can survive anything that battle has to offer. As you can see, we're quite safe here in Beauvais and keeping busy. One of the Red Cross men told us yesterday, we don't need any more women who want to hold the dying soldiers' hands. We need ones like you who can wash dishes. If you'll believe it, he meant it as a compliment. He told me that it gave him hope to see women of refinement, that's me apparently, have the spirit to take on the ugly jobs, cleaning up messes, scrubbing floors, and washing dishes. I know you wanted something more from me, Ma. I know you scrubbed because you had to and not because you wanted to. Everywhere we've been, there's been squalor and confusion, and we've been able to plunge in and turn it all around. And that's something I learned from you. Even when we were poorest, you took what little we had and you made it work somehow. You always found a way. I'll never be able to thank you enough for showing me that it isn't what you have, it's what you make of it. Whether it's turning a can of sardines and some condensed milk into a supper, or turning a group of strangers into a band of sisters. I don't know when I'll be back. The work keeps coming and coming, and sometimes it seems like this war will never be over, and I haven't quite given up the hope that we'll be able to go back to Grey Corps and set that to rights again, too. But I'm sending love to Dad and the boys, and particularly to you. Happy Mother's Day, Ma. With love, your Katie. Miss Catherine Moran, class of 1911, assistant director, to her mother, Mrs. Frances Shaughnessy. May 1918. Beauvais, France. Have you written your letter yet? Kate asked Emmy. Emmy looked down at the crossed-out piece of paper in front of her. In the hall of the club, a large sign had been posted. Today is Mother's Day. Have you written your letter? Emmy had spent the morning visiting hospitals, helping the boys there write their letters home. Some had been lovely. Others had been heartbreaking. The boys who couldn't hold a pen. The boys who could hardly speak because their lungs were so groggy from being gassed. The boys who were never going home again, no matter how they pretended. But no matter how she tried, she couldn't seem to write her own. Dear Mother, she had written, and then she stuck. Because what could she possibly tell her mother of their life here, of the calls from the station, the trains that went through, unloading the lost and the wounded? They knew all the trains now. The improvised trains for the petits blessés, the lightly wounded, who needed to be fed with rich soups and brought cigarettes and a hard bread they sarcastically called gâteau, who would thank them for the English papers and joke and laugh with them. Then there were the permanent trains for the grands blessés, those who were grievously hurt, who could only be tempted by oranges and chocolate, and who needed letters written with alarming urgency to send their last messages back home. The grands blessés were the saddest, but even the petits blessés were a heartbreaking sight, crawling out of the straw, their uniforms so matted with dirt and blood it was nearly impossible to discern the original color. The unit was doing good work. Emmy knew they were doing good work. They were busy and useful and together and working in a terribly organized way, sleeping in proper beds and eating proper meals, and she couldn't remember the last time she had been so unhappy. It wasn't just unhappiness. It had taken Emmy some time to identify the feeling because it was so unexpected. She was angry, with a horrible, snarling, brooding sort of anger that colored everything. It made her resentful and hateful. She hated that they'd had to leave Grey Corps. She hated the work. She hated the new people with their cheerful assumption that this was what they were here for, this was what they were meant to do. She hated seeing the broken men with their broken bodies and broken spirits, the huddled refugees passing through, headed goodness only knew where. She hated all the articles praising the unit for being angels of mercy and towers of strength when she didn't feel either merciful or angelic. She just felt furious. She hated that she'd found the one person in the world she'd wanted to spend her life with, the one person in the world who looked at her and saw something wonderful, and now she hadn't the faintest idea where he was or if he was alive or dead. It wasn't heroic or patriotic. It was wasteful and horrible. And now, this letter to her mother, it was the very last straw. Emmy couldn't, wouldn't write what she knew her mother wanted to hear. How marvelous it all was. What a fine showing they were making. She couldn't speak of the people they served as statistics. So many fed, so many outfitted, so many sent on. Alice had been collecting funerals. They'd seen so many men die, so many without family, Scotsmen from remote islands, boys from Kentucky farms, New Yorkers, Liverpudlians, and Nova Scotians, that Alice had taken it on herself to attend every funeral she could, to make sure someone was there to bear witness. She wrote to all the next of kin after, a personal letter in addition to the official one. Emmy had promised she would help her, with the letters, not the funerals, but she found it so very hard. She found it all so very hard. Emmy wanted to be back at Grey Corps, with her chickens who were really roosters, and with the hope of summer to come. She wanted to deliver milk to adorable pink Boche babies, not cigarettes to men wounded beyond bearing. Maybe that made her unpatriotic. Maybe that made her ungenerous. She wasn't sure. Mostly, it made her moody. Kate had taken to checking in on her. Not explicitly, just stopping by throughout the day, saying a word or two, giving Emmy a chance to fume if she needed it. That, at least, was one good thing that had come of all this. She had Kate back again. Not in the old, blithe way of the Smith days, but in a new, more concerted way. They'd stopped taking each other for granted. They listened to each other now, really listened. And sometimes, like now, it was enough just to be, to know the other was there. "Is that your letter?" asked Kate, perching on the arm of Emmy's chair. Emmy grimaced at the marked-up page. "I haven't gotten very far. Do you think it counts if I write to my brothers instead?"
"Or you could just give an interview to the papers," said Kate blandly.
And Emmy made a horrible face at her, because, of course, that was just what Emmy's mother had done after the evacuation, when the Smith unit was in all the papers. She'd told the New York Times that it was no more than she would have expected of her daughter, and it was time the world recognized the potential of the modern college woman. Emmy wasn't sure which bothered her more,
The idea that this was somehow a measure of her being her mother's daughter, or the idea that she was meant to be an archetype of the modern college woman, a bloodless model of an ideal, rather than a person who had tramped through mud and gone 2 weeks at a time without a shampoo, and cried over spilled chickens, and found immeasurable joy teaching children to sing rounds in French. There was a time, not so very long ago, when she would have been delighted to have made her mother proud, whatever that meant. But now, she was just so angry.
She hasn't the faintest notion, said Emmy. Of course, why should she? No one would who hasn't been here. But
the thoughtlessness of it all, the complete lack of any attempt to understand, the idea that they were just grist for her mother's mill. Emmy was certainly happy that people were seeing the potential of the American college woman, and it didn't at all offend her when Mr. Hamlin of the Red Cross said the exact same thing, or when Major Perkins wired that they needed more college girls like the Smith unit in France. But when her mother said it to a paper, it made her want to snarl.
I keep thinking about that night in Amiens.
Emmy looked up at Kate, struggling to put her emotions into words.
You remember, that horrible cellar with the bombs falling and falling?
Oh, I remember, said Kate with feeling.
That was the first time I really thought we might die. Actually die, not just talk about it. Those bombs didn't care who we were. It didn't matter to them that we were Smith girls or les dames américaines. They were just falling anywhere they landed, obliterating everything in their paths. We might have been anyone. Maybe that's what's bothering me. I don't think my mother has ever, in her whole life, been somewhere where she's been just anyone. All those railings she chained herself to, no one was ever going to arrest her, not really.
The police were never going to haul Mrs. Livingston Van Alden off to the tombs or beat her with a nightstick, not when she was the niece of a senator and second cousin to a former president.
I know that doesn't make it a sham, precisely, said Emmy slowly. None of it changes what she's done. We probably wouldn't have the vote in New York now if it weren't for her, and if we ever get to vote nationally, it will owe something to her, so I suppose she has done more good for more people than I ever could, but
it doesn't seem quite so heroic anymore, offered Kate. Emmy nodded. All her life, her mother was the model she'd striven to follow. She was Lady Liberty and the entire pantheon of Greek goddesses all rolled into one. Emmy had tried so very hard to contort herself into what her mother wanted her to be, to follow her mother's example. Emmy looked down at her unwritten letter, the ink blurring in front of her.
It makes me so angry that she's trying to take credit for our work when she hasn't been here, when she hasn't done any of it. And it's nothing to take credit for. It was just surviving. The things that we did that were good, the things that matter, those are the things she doesn't care about. Like getting pumps for the villages and making sure there were enough combs to go around and teaching the children to play again. Those were the things that mattered. And that's what no one seems to care about now.
You could always write her that, said Kate.
She'd never read it.
Emmy was fairly sure her mother had never read any of the letters she'd written home from Smith.
And I'd just feel silly and petty for writing it. We're meant to be keeping our end up.
I don't think keeping our end up means pretending everything is wonderful when it isn't, said Kate. It's a war. It's meant to be awful. Emmy managed a wobbly smile.
I hate the work we're doing here. You don't, do you?
I don't hate it, no. Not the way you do. If we'd done this from the beginning, I'm not sure I would have minded it so much. But I feel like Graycore spoiled me for other things.
I know this is what's needed, but it's just so disheartening. I keep thinking of all our people and wondering where they are now and whether we'll ever be able to keep our promises to them.
It had all seemed possible in Montdidier, with the mud of Graycore still fresh on their boots. But that had been in March, and now it was May, and the Germans still pressed on. The idea of going back, rebuilding, seemed impossibly remote.
Sometimes I wonder if there was any point in it. We worked so hard, and then it was all swept away again.
There was silence for a moment as the wheels of ambulances rumbled by on the street outside, bringing more wounded, always more wounded.
If we had never come, said Kate, hundreds of people would have died this winter. They may have lost their homes again, but they're alive. They can go back. We can go back for them.
Can we? The new girls have no idea. They seem to think this is what the unit is for, nursing and canteen work.
But we know what it's for, said Kate. And Emmy had never been more grateful for Kate's determination, that streak of mulishness so entirely at odds with her fine-boned delicacy.
Florence would go back in a moment. She's held on to the cows and goats for just that purpose. She takes it as a personal affront that she wasn't able to finish the planting. And Liza, too.
Liza?
Emmy looked up at Kate in surprise.
But she always wanted to do canteen work.
She says she misses the store, and being outdoors, and fresh air.
Kate glanced over her shoulder, checking to make sure no one was listening. It was always really Maud who wanted to do canteen work, and now Maud's left, Liza doesn't have to listen to her anymore.
Emmy sat a little straighter, feeling a faint, dangerous spark of hope.
What about Nell and Anne and Alice?
I haven't spoken to them yet. I know Anne misses her school in Boston. I doubt she'll want to stay on that long. Nell might, but I'm not sure.
Kate looked at her seriously. It wouldn't be for a while, you know. We're not going to make it back to Greycorn until the war is over.
If the war ever ended.
Emmy stared down at her hands, large-fingered, calloused, bare of rings.
Will and I used to talk about what we'd do after the war. It was like a game, only it wasn't.
She felt Kate's hand on her shoulder.
Has there been any word?
It was amazing how hard it could be to choke out one syllable.
No.
She'd searched and searched the casualty lists for Will's name. Of 30 officers from his battalion, 22 had been officially reported dead. Emmy wasn't quite sure what that meant for the other 8. Will wasn't marked as missing, there was that. Did that mean he was sick somewhere, wounded, or simply serving wherever it was he had been called to serve? The censorship of the French papers was so complete, it was almost impossible to get any information. They had no idea who was doing what, where, only rumors. It was at times like these that being engaged to be engaged seemed a rather flimsy thing. If they'd been engaged, properly engaged, she might have done what her mother would have done and badgered every relative who had contacts anywhere in the State Department or at the Court of St. James's. She would have had the phone lines buzzing, diplomats calling hospitals. But it was very hard to explain to the authorities that a pile of letters signed yours to be yours counted as at all the same thing as an engagement announcement in the Times. Not to mention that the letters themselves were now somewhere behind enemy lines, in a locked trunk, in an army barrack, behind an abandoned chateau, most likely torched by the Germans.
I ask on every train, said Kate, and Julia knows to keep a lookout when she does her rounds.
I know. I suppose it's better that he hasn't turned up. It means he's off fighting somewhere.
Or dead. Emmy made a show of checking the clock on the mantel.
Oh dear, if we don't get moving, we'll be late for our shift at the station.
She left the letter to her mother unfinished. If her mother wanted to know what they were doing, she could read it in the papers. It was a small defiance, but it made Emmy feel better in a petty sort of way. She did write to her brothers, though. For them, she wrote a cheerful letter talking about the unexpected visitors who would stop by, the group of aviators knocking on their door saying, "Hello, Smith Unit. Just wanted to say hello. We're the Lafayette Escadrille." She wrote about the sing-alongs they had twice a week at the club, with Dr. Clare pounding out a combination of hymns and light opera.
"We go from Onward Christian Soldiers to I Am the Very Model of a Modern Major General. The only thing they have in common is that they're both martial, and we can't sing either of them on key."
One group of men who had come through the club sent them 346 francs to buy a Victrola. So other poor boys won't have to listen to Dr. Claire singing, suggested Kate, sotto voce, making Emmy choke on her coffee. The Smith Club of Japan sent two boxes of supplies, including the most beautiful writing paper Emmy had ever seen, silky and whisper-thin. It made her think of gossamer and butterfly wings and the stuff of dreams, the sort of paper that should be used for writing poetry and love letters, like something out of that Keats poem, or was it Coleridge, with casements opening upon fairy lands forlorn. Nothing like the sturdy stuff on which she and Will had exchanged letters, a motley collection of stationery cadged from Paris hotels and paper torn from notebooks, and on one occasion, when nothing better could be found, brown paper packaging cut into squares. Emmy gave the paper to Alice for her condolence notes, which were multiplying at an alarming rate as May raged into June and the Germans kept on and on. Sirens screeched overhead. There was something far more fearsome about an air raid in a city than in the countryside. At Grey Corps, they'd managed to make a joke of it, but here, in Beauvais, the planes screaming overhead were fearsome things. The cannon boomed, the anti-aircraft guns fired, and the church bells rang in frenzied cacophony as the Boche planes screamed past on their way to Paris, dropping bombs in their wake. The wounded poured into Beauvais. The train station was a terrible thing, trains belching out the dead and the dying in a fog of smoke and blood. Emmy had only just fallen into bed, still wearing her soiled uniform, when Mrs. Barrett shook her awake. We're all needed at the hospital. They made their way through a nightmare landscape of smoldering houses and shattered glass, dodging craters in the pavement, whole streets blocked off by rubble. There were American nurses in the hospital, just shipped in from Paris, some just in from the U.S. One was being sick in a corner. Emmy couldn't blame her. The floor was thick with stretchers, with hungry, filthy, thirsty, feverish men all dropped wherever the stretcher bearers had been able to find room. It was almost impossible to see. Lights were allowed only in the operating room. For the rest, there were only shuttered lanterns, creating more shadows than sight. Across the way, in the operating room, under the glare of the lights, all three tables were full. Dr. Claire bending over one, Julia over another, and a French surgeon manning the third. Someone was carrying men out of the operating room, someone else lining up stretchers waiting to go in, the men so bloodied they looked less like human beings than like meat hanging out in front of a butcher's shop.
Anne, Mrs. Barrett was saying, there are 45 grands blessés just out of surgery in there, if you could tend to them. Emmy, this lot has just come in.
Emmy didn't even bother to take off her hat or her gloves. She found a container of drinking water and began making the rounds, one by one, checking each for fever and wounds, offering water, wiping their faces as best she could. The whistles were still blowing and the bombs falling, the walls shaking with each explosion, but the noise seemed to recede as she worked, the horror outside less than the horror within. She had never imagined anything like this, not in Grey Corps, not in the evacuation, not even in Amiens. She was balling up a blanket to try to use as a bolster for a wounded man when Kate tapped her on the shoulder.
Emmy, Emmy, come with me.
But I'm not done here.
It's your captain.
Kate had blood on her face and her dress. Her usually neat hair was straggling out of its pins.
I think it's your captain. I've been helping in the operating room.
Emmy was on her feet in an instant, feeling sick with hope and fear.
But these men,
Nell says she'll stay with them.
Emmy hadn't even noticed Nell, but there she was, behind Kate, taking over without a word. Nell, who usually had a pithy comment for every occasion, her eyes burning hollows in her white face.
Go,
Nell said, and gave Emmy a little push. They had to step over more stretchers to get there, to the operating room, where a man lay on Julia's table as she dug a needle in and out of his flesh. Emmy had only a glimpse of his face, a face pitted with burns and scrapes from exploding shrapnel, before there was a tremendous crash and all the lights went out. She could hear Julia cursing, and then a flashlight was shoved into Emmy's hand. "Hold that," she said crisply, and Emmy held the flashlight as still as she could. That momentary glimpse of his face burned into her memory, trying to resist the urge to turn the beam of the light and look again.
"How bad?"
Julia shoved wadding into the wound. "It missed anything important. He'll live, as long as it doesn't go putrid on him." "What?" she demanded, as someone came up behind her.
"The alert has sounded," said Mrs. Barrett grimly. "The officer in charge has suggested you stop and seek a place of safety."
"Jamais," protested the French surgeon working at the next table. "I operate all night."
"While there are wounded here, I stay here." Julia snapped her fingers at the stretcher bearers. "Take him away and bring the next one." On her other side, Dr. Claire, who had been operating for 12 hours straight, her usually immaculate hair matted with sweat, her apron covered in unspeakable fluids, was wordlessly humming "Onward, Christian Soldiers" as she bent her head over the man on the table. Handing off her flashlight to Kate, Emmy took one side of the stretcher, helping the stretcher bearer lower it to the floor in one of the wards. The room was humid with sweat and fear, the air acrid with the smell of burning things. The darkness was horrible, making all the smells and sounds more acute, playing tricks of perspective. The room might have been the size of a closet or a baseball field, she couldn't tell. All lights were needed for the operating room. The men in recovery would just have to lump it. Emmy touched what she thought was his shoulder.
"Will?"
she whispered.
"Emmy?"
His voice was hoarse, but it was his.
"Emmy, I can't see."
She felt like laughing, which was an entirely inappropriate reaction, but she couldn't help it. She was such a mix of joy and fear.
"It's the lights," she said. "The Germans have shot the power out."
She heard him draw a shaky breath.
"Thank God. I thought I'd gone blind. I thought I was never going to see your face again."
"Where have you been?"
As soon as she said it, Emmy realized it was really a rather ridiculous thing to ask. He'd been fighting. She groped for his hand, clutching his cold fingers. She didn't like that they were so cold.
"I couldn't get any word. I only heard that most of your battalion—
Slaughtered."
His voice was very weak.
"I had pneumonia. Out of my head with it. I'd been knocked into a trench hole and apparently lay there for 3 days before some Frenchies found me. That's what they told me. I don't remember any of it. When I came to, they declared me fit for service and sent me out again. It's all been a bit of a blur."
Emmy clung to his hand. It was so strange to be able to hold him but not see him, to feel the shape of his palm, the calluses on his fingers, as if she were learning the geography of him, one small isthmus at a time.
"I left your letters in Greycourt. They were all I had of you, and I left them."
"They were only paper and ink. The words, the thoughts, whatever was in them of any value, you have already. It all amounted to just one thing anyway."
"Yes."
The bombs were still falling outside. There were roughly 40 other wounded men packed around them, nurses navigating as best they could in the dark. But right now, there was nothing in the world but Will, here, with her, the rasp of his breath, the feel of his fingers around hers.
"I love you,"
he said in his beautiful voice, scratchy now, faint, but still his.
"Whatever happens, wherever we go, in this world or the next."
"You're not going to any other world but this," said Emmy fiercely, swiping away tears with her free hand and giving an entirely inelegant sniff. "Julia said it was a perfectly incompetent shell and missed anything that mattered, so you're not allowed to go all elegiac on me."
"A valediction, forbidding mourning,"
he managed.
"Yes, Kate gave me your message about the compass."
Emmy's throat was so thick with emotion she could hardly get the words out.
"It's all very romantic, but you've got it all wrong. I'm not forbidding mourning. I'm forbidding dying. I simply won't have it. You're not allowed."
He gave a shaky laugh that turned into a gasp of pain.
"I'll do my best."
The sirens were wailing for all they were worth. Some of the men were crying, Others praying. Another bomb crashed down, closer now. Emmy could hear glass shattering and someone screaming, screaming, and screaming, alarmingly close. Will pressed something into her hand, something hard and round and cool.
This is my signet. If I promise to try not to die, will you promise to wear it? I'd go down on one knee, but since I'm already prone.
Emmy leaned over and kissed him. She didn't quite get the right part of his mouth, but they got that sorted out rather quickly. She couldn't embrace him because she didn't want to tear his stitches, and they both reeked rather strongly of sweat and blood, but she found that didn't matter in the slightest. Emmy. Kate squeezed her shoulder.
Emmy, I'm so sorry, but we have to go.
We're engaged, Emmy said, the words feeling very small in the darkness.
Will's ring was loose on her finger.
For real this time.
Congratulations. Emmy couldn't see Kate, but she could feel the hem of her uniform skirt swishing back and forth, a clear sign of anxiety.
I mean it, I do. I'm very happy for you both, but we're all being evacuated. Now.
I don't understand.
Emmy sat back on her knees, clenching her hand around Will's ring to keep it from falling off. It was too loose. She would have to wrap string under it to keep it on, or maybe hang it on a chain around her neck.
What happened?
Part of the hospital is gone.
Kate was trying to sound calm and businesslike, but Emmy could hear the panic under it.
They want us to get our things from the hotel. It's not safe in Beauvais anymore. You're being evacuated too, Captain DeWitt, but I'm not sure where.
Will?
Emmy stared down at the dim shape on the stretcher. It seemed such a cruel trick to not even be able to see him, to see his face before they were parted again.
I'm sorry, said Kate. I'm so sorry.
Behind them, Emmy could hear people bustling about, stretchers being lifted, men moaning, Dr. Claire protesting about something. Will squeezed her hand and then, very deliberately, let it go.
Go, he said. Be safe. I'll find you, wherever you are. Remember, the compass.
The points always come together again.
Emmy leaned over and kissed him one last time, not caring who saw, knowing Kate would understand.
When the war ends, come find me at Greycourt.
Epilogue. May, 1919. Greycourt, France.
Dear everyone at home, we've been busy as clams since we got back to Greycourt in January. Or do I mean happy as clams? We've been working pretty much dawn to dusk getting everything up and running again. You should have seen the havoc those Boches wreaked on our poor old barracks. It's as if they didn't think they did the job properly the first time. But this time, at least, we have plenty of supplies and men to help us. All those French soldiers home from the war, and the men and women who were away avec les Boches have been filtering back home, and they've been building and plowing just as hard as they can. We've even got a bunch of German prisoners of war working for us, which is a little unnerving, although they're sweet as lambs, most of them. I kept thinking they'd have spikes growing out of their heads and teeth like the wolf in Red Riding Hood, but they're pretty much normal boys and bewildered as can be. Kate claims she still can't get used to being called director, which is nonsense since she was pretty much director anyway, even when she wasn't. Mrs. Barrett sends love and packages from home. Her husband was sent back home to the States after the armistice in November, so she felt she had to resign and go back with him. But she says she'll always be with us in spirit, and as long as the mails keep delivering. There are only four of us old contemptibles left. Florence Luz is having a ball with chickens and cows. Emmy Van Alden is in charge of social work. Julia Prine is our medical department. And you'd laugh to see me in charge of the store, peddling away like anything. I've been setting up shops in all the villages and helping the locals to stock them. The new girls are a good lot, even if they do keep asking us to tell stories about the early days at Greycourt and what it was like to be here under fire, which makes me feel like the ancient someone or other from that poem. We've had a rash of romances. Alice Patton, from the old crew, wrote that she's married one of the engineers. The unit sent her a silver dish as a wedding present. There's an aviator from the Lafayette Escadrille who's been calling on Kate. He shows off flying around in circles, although Kate claims he's just a friend of the unit. Ha! Oh, and you'll never imagine who came riding in on a farm cart last week with 8 boxes of chocolates, 5 rose bushes, and a luxury assortment of DeWitt's biscuits. None other than DeWitt's biscuits himself. Although Emmy has asked us to please stop calling him Captain Biscuit. For some reason, she doesn't find that the least bit funny. He was demobbed in April, and they're to be married next month from St. George's Anglican Church in Paris, with Kate as maid of honor, and Florence Lewes, Julia Prine, the groom's sister, and yours truly as bridesmaids. The dresses were a problem, with rationing, but in the end we decided we'd just wear our uniforms and brighten them up a bit with some flowers, of which there's no shortage right now. We've got enough growing wild on the lawn to stock a shop. That little French girl, Zaylee, is going to be flower girl and toss rose petals. We were worried about losing Emmy, but she's promised to stay on with her captain until we get the work done enough to hand off to the French, so we think of it not so much as losing a unit member as gaining a source of biscuits. Oh dear, Minerva's got into the wash again and Marie is throwing a fit and threatening to have her turned into stew. At least, I think that's what she's saying. It's in French, and there are still some phrases I haven't picked up yet. More later. With love, Liza.
Miss Liza Shaw, class of 1909, to Mr. and Mrs. Robert F. Shaw, Jr. June, 1919. Paris, France. I can't imagine why I bothered to go all the way to Paris for Emmeline's wedding. It was a most irregular affair, such a peculiar collection of women as bridesmaids, all dressed in those hideous gray uniforms instead of proper dresses. I know one can't expect much of these college women, but you'd think they might have made an effort for the occasion. When I asked, they told me they'd done it on purpose. Emmeline had requested it. I can only imagine Emmeline thought it would make her look better by contrast, choosing a bunch of dowds as bridesmaids and putting them in gray wool. I could have wept to see Julia there in that dingy gray. She ought to have been maid of honor. Anyone would agree it was her right. But that honor went to that horrible little charity girl Emmeline dragged home with her from Smith instead of her very own cousin. When I pointed out to Julia what an insult it was, she only looked at me and said I knew nothing about it. I don't know why anyone even bothers to have children when they behave like this. In any event, you would think Cora would be delighted that she finally found someone to take Emmeline off her hands. There's a title there, even if it's a new one, but with those feet, it's a miracle that Emmeline found anyone. I suppose nearly dying does lower a man's standards. Instead, Cora seemed positively disappointed that Emmeline had chosen to marry instead of demanding the leadership of that pokey old unit of theirs. I don't understand it. There's Emmeline, as plain as shoe leather, married to DeWitt's biscuits, while my Julia is off poking the tonsils of French peasants. There's no justice in the world. The only consolation is that the groom's family seems quite as mad as Emmeline. There must be insanity in the family. It's the only explanation. The father, Lord DeWitt, only wanted to talk about model villages, whatever that means. The sister, who was one of the bridesmaids, was the most militant sort of new woman. All she could talk about was her college at Oxford and the vote for women and other perfectly boring things. She and Cora took to one another immediately. It gave me a crushing headache. Or maybe that was the champagne. I had to drink a great deal of it to alleviate the boredom. There was no call at all for Cora to tell them to stop filling my glass. There were a number of men at the wedding, including one of the Nelson boys, mother a Stuyvesant, father in railroads, who would do very nicely for Julia. Not as much money as the DeWitt boy, but a far better pedigree. Union Club, Knickerbocker, etc., Yale 08. Did something with airplanes during the war, but of course that's all over now. I might have pointed Julia in his direction once or twice, but just to spite me, I'm sure, she practically shoved him at that horrible little mouse of a Moran girl. What's the use of even trying? Julia's complexion is quite ruined from tramping about the French countryside.
When I gently suggested to her that some face cream might be in order, she only laughed at me and told me that her patients didn't care what she looked like. It has been a most trying day. There's no point in staying in Paris. There isn't a person I know here anymore, at least no one anyone would want to know. Besides, I can't afford it. Cora refuses to pay my bill at the Ritz. She had the gall to suggest I stay somewhere within my means. At least Emmeline has some family feeling. She's booked me a first-class cabin back to New York, and I mean to take it. Julia will just have to manage without me. From the diary of Madame la Comtesse de Taligourd, née May Van Alden. June 1919, Paris, France. That was a three-handkerchief wedding. The right sort of crying, not the wrong sort. Miss Van Alden floated down the aisle. Yes, Lawrence, I know that's not physically possible, but allow me some license. Her groom stared at her like he couldn't believe his luck. Some might call it shell shock, but I'm pretty sure it's love. Yes, I know I'm just an old romantic. I married you, didn't I? Betsy, being Betsy, claims full credit for the match on the grounds that if she hadn't formed the unit, they would never have met, and spent the whole time beaming maternally at them when she wasn't using up my handkerchiefs because she'd forgotten to bring her own. I'll admit, it made me a little weepy to see the old crew again, from our new director all the way down to little Zaylee, who served as flower girl and took her petal tossing very seriously. They made her a junior version of the uniform to wear, and you've never seen anyone look more pleased. With a bit of cutting of red tape in the right places, she is now officially the ward of our director, Miss Moran, although she's really been adopted by the whole unit. She has a bit of a limp from her experience during the retreat, but Dr. Prine did an excellent job of patching her up. I may have taken a look during the reception. I've told Julia that there's a job waiting for her in Philadelphia at College Hospital whenever she's done at Grey Corps. She pretended not to be interested, but I think she'll take it, eventually. It was a beautiful thing to watch the bride rush back to hug everyone again and again. Even yours truly came in for a hug or two. She was the sort of happy that wants everyone to be happy with her, and it was wonderful to see how delighted the Grey Corps crew were for her, and how they welcomed her husband. Well, roasted him, really, but that's how they show their affection, these girls. When I think what these girls were when they arrived, it warms even my flinty heart to see how they've come together. Particularly Dr. Prine, Miss Moran, and Miss Van Alden, whom I must try to remember to call Mrs. DeWitt now. The way they look after each other is something beautiful to behold. It seems a shame that they'll be separated once the work is done, but I don't imagine they'll let anything keep them apart for long. Oh, bother. Now I'm getting weepy again, and Betsy's walked off with all my handkerchiefs. Dr. Ava Stringfellow, class of 1896, to her husband, Dr. Lawrence Stringfellow. July 1919, Grey Corps, France. Darling Emmy, yes, we have everything in hand, and no, you don't need to come back early. Please do stop writing us and just enjoy your honeymoon. That's a request as your friend, not an order as your director, but don't think I won't pull rank if I have to. Zaylee loves the beads you sent her from Venice. She won't take them off, which means we can always hear her jingling everywhere she goes. Julia loves the ticket you sent her mother. She'll never tell you herself, but she's terribly grateful to you for sending her packing. There really isn't anything to say about Lieutenant Nelson, but I promise to tell you whatever there is when you come home. I won't say you aren't missed, because you are. But we want you to have a little time for yourselves before we put you both back to work. You're always so busy taking care of everyone else that you never stop to think of yourself, so we're going to think of you for you and absolutely forbid you to return for at least a month. We'll set Minerva on you if you do. All my love, Kate. P.S. Tell Will we've proclaimed him an honorary unit member and Madame Gougeot is sewing him a uniform as we speak. From Miss Catherine Moran, class of 1911,
to the Honorable Mrs. Fitzwilliam DeWitt, nee Emmeline Van Alden, class of 1911. August 1919, Graycourt, France.
Venice was lovely, and so was Rome, but I've never seen anything so lovely as sunrise through the gates of Graycourt. It's a wonderful thing to come home. I wish I could shrink it all and put it in a snow globe to put in my pocket and take with me when we're done here. Kate says we have it anyway, in our memories. Julia tells me not to spew sentimental tripe. And Will? Will made me a snow globe with the gates of Graycourt in it. Has there ever been anyone as lucky as I?
From the diary of the Honorable Mrs. Fitzwilliam DeWitt, nee Emmeline Van Alden, class of 1911. Historical note. Back in 2018, I was trying to find information about Christmas customs in Picardy during World War I, as one does, and stumbled on Ladies of Graycourt, a memoir by Ruth Gaines of the Smith College Relief Unit. It turned out that her book was absolutely useless in terms of Picard Christmas traditions, but I was fascinated by the fact that there was, somehow, a group of American college women in the Somme, right next to the lines, arranging Christmas parties for French villagers. It wasn't what I was supposed to be working on at all, but I couldn't help myself. I plowed through that memoir, captivated by Gaines's account of how the unit came to be, what they did, how it all turned out, and I was tantalized by a few enigmatic comments and inconsistencies. Why did their director, the force behind the whole expedition, resign less than 2 weeks after they arrived at Graycourt? What exactly was Gaines getting at when she wrote, "The only limitations to that high experience were the limits of comprehension, of endeavor, of fellowship set by our own personalities"? I'd attended an all-girls school. That carefully phrased line about the limits of fellowship set by personalities sent out a bat signal to me. I smelled drama. So I did what any procrastinating author would do. I started digging, first into the publicly available sources, which raised still more questions, and then into the vast piles of letters and journals by unit members housed in the Sophia Smith Collection at Smith College. The story I found in those letters is the story that you read in this book. Basically, leaving aside the emotional dramas of my own pretend people, if something happened in the book, it happened to the Smith unit. The unit was founded in April of 1917 by Harriet Boyd Hawes, a highly eccentric and volatile pioneering archaeologist and humanitarian who delivered a stirring speech at the Smith College Club in April, pulled together volunteers, backers, and supplies with record speed, and embarked on the Rochambeau with a brand new Smith College relief unit in uniforms of gray, with touches of French blue, in late July. Wherever I could, I stuck with their own experiences and timeline. There wasn't enough room in the inn when they arrived at Paris. They did wrangle an attic to sleep in. The chauffeurs did have to go to Saint-Nazaire to put their trucks together. Their agriculturalist, Francis Valentine, was delayed in D.C., leaving another member to fill in. And that other member did accidentally buy roosters instead of chickens. The unit did visit the American Ambulance Hospital in Neuilly, where a member fainted and later dropped out entirely. The incident with a small child, who was hit by a ball and began screaming, thinking it was a bomb, was taken from a letter by a distraught unit member. Kate and Emmy's terrifying experience with the poilus at a deserted inn, including rescue by Canadian foresters, came directly from the letters of Marjorie Pidge Carr and Catherine Hooper. Two unit members were indeed sent to ask a very important official about acquiring poultry and wound up being lectured about pigeons. Most dramatically, I discovered that, yes, there was a coup within the unit, and the sudden disappearance of the director, Harriet Boyd Hawes, was not, as it was put out in the public materials, for health reasons, but because of a deliberate campaign to remove her, a coup driven partly by personality and partly by a disagreement about the nature of the unit. As in the book, the faction succeeded in removing Hawes, who was replaced as director first by the unit's doctor, Alice Weld Talent, and then by Hannah Andrews, the Mrs. Barrett of the book, but not in altering her vision for the unit. And yes, the Smith College Relief Unit did ignore British orders to evacuate during a German onslaught and instead drove right into the fray and evacuated their villages. Everything you read about the March 1918 invasion in the book, the Smithies did, including directing traffic for the Great Retreat. Even more remarkable, they all came through unscathed in real life as well as in my fiction. I did bend the truth in places. You may have noticed that although there are references throughout the book to there being 18 original unit members, if you count the named characters, there are actually only 15. That was because I found it impossible to keep 18 personalities straight, and if I couldn't keep track of them, how would my readers? It also replicated my experience reading the letters, where some members certainly stood out more strongly than others, with a core of perhaps 10 who seemed to play the largest role in the unit's dramas and made for the best copy. My apologies to anyone who actually did the math and realized I was 3 characters short. If there's an incident in the book, it almost certainly happened, but I may have moved it or conflated events for simplicity's sake. In the book, all of the women drive down to Grey Corps together. In real life, one chunk of the group went to Grey Corps on September 11th, as described, issues with a pass, breakdown, loaned poilu and all, while another chunk stayed in Paris and came down a few days later. In the book, Emmy is delighted at having wrangled benches for their schoolhouses, keeping a French bureaucrat from his lunch in October. In real life, that exact incident happened in January. In the book, Margaret has a breakdown after seeing a boy who had been deliberately maimed by the German occupiers. In real life, that didn't happen to the girl who dropped out. It did happen, but to a different unit member, and later in the year. That unit member wrote home that she'd seen something so shocking it had changed her whole life and made her decide to stop shilly-shallying and accept the proposal of the man she loved. And so on. I also used real events as inspiration for fictional twists. Kate going missing at the end of the book was my own invention, but it was inspired by 2 unit members being left at the crossroads in Hua and other unit members defying Dr. Baldwin's instructions and going back for them. There was, in fact, an English major, not a captain, who gifted the unit with duck walk, but Captain DeWitt was entirely my own invention, even if unit romances were not. There was at least one marriage that came out of the unit's adventures. As one member reported in her letters home, there were a number of affairs in progress between unit members and their various admirers, but very little privacy in which to conduct them. I could go on and on, comparing each incident in the book with its antecedent in real life, but then this historical note would be as long as the book. I have never had the privilege of dealing with as rich a source of anecdote as the chatty, snarky, fascinating letters written home by the members of the Smith College Relief Unit. My only regret was that I couldn't include even more of their adventures and mishaps in the book. There were times when I was highly tempted to abandon the whole project and put together an annotated version of their letters instead, because the truth was even more incredible than fiction. The letter excerpts at the start of each chapter, some very closely paraphrased from actual letters, are my nod to the amazing corpus of material left by the real members of the Smith College Relief Unit. However, since I did go on with the novel, this is where the book departs from the historical record. The events are real, but all the women in this novel are fictional. Some are more fictional than others. Some, like Kate and Emmy, were entirely the product of my imagination. Others were more or less closely inspired by the characters of the actual members of the unit as they conveyed themselves to me from their personal letters. Mrs. Rutherford is based, with some fictional flourishes, on Harriet Boyd Hawes, the real founder of the Smith Unit, a pioneering archaeologist and war nurse who once forgot her baby in a stationery shop in Northampton. Dr. Stringfellow was a stand-in for the amazing Alice Weld Talent, who did have really quite dramatic eyebrows, but was not, in fact, Mrs. Hawes's college roommate, or even her same class year. Nell Baldwin, the unit's librarian, was inspired by the letters of Alice Levins, who wrote movingly of begging for books for the children. Florence Lewes was my answer to Francis Valentine, the unit's agriculturalist, who, like my imaginary replacement, wasn't able to arrive until November, and wrote home about how it was much warmer not to attempt to wash. Liza Shaw was inspired in part by Catherine Hooper, who wrote home so feelingly about food and who did such a marvelous job with the traveling store. My two heroines, Emmy Van Alden and Kate Moran, and Emmy's cousin, Julia Prine, are really quite genuinely fictional, although the inspiration for Kate did come from two real members of the unit. When I first read Ruth Gaines's memoirs, I was struck by the subtle difference in attitude toward Maud Kelly, the unit's junior doctor, the only Catholic member of the unit. The underlying vein of anti-Catholic sentiment came out even more strongly in some of the private letters of a handful of the unit members. Looking into the history of Smith College, I was struck by the fact that the number of Catholic students in any given class at the turn of the century was in the single digits. What would life have been like for a Catholic student at Smith, or after? The other inspiration for Kate was Marie Wolfe's class of 1908, a Smith grad whose home is listed as Newark, New Jersey, but who was of Belgian parentage and was in Liège when the war broke out. Marie's letters are just as colloquial and smithy as the rest of the women's, but she is frequently referred to in both articles and the private letters as a Belgian refugee, or that Belgian girl, something that sets her apart from the others, even though she got along with everyone and seems to have neatly avoided factions and feuds. Like my fictional Kate, Marie Wolfe's was appointed assistant director of the unit and wound up in charge of the evacuation, as their director, Mrs. Andrews, had been summoned to Paris for the week for meetings with the Red Cross. Like Kate, Marie Wolfe's returned to France as director of the unit after the war to oversee the rebuilding of their villages. Emmy was inspired by the many references in the women's letters to both the suffrage movement. The winning of the vote for women in New York was something that was followed by the members of the unit with great interest, and the New Yorkers in the group crowed mercilessly over their less fortunate companions, and their background in settlement house work, which deeply informed the whole structure and nature of the unit. Briefly put, the settlement house movement was a charitable initiative in which upper-middle-class women would move into an underserved urban neighborhood and provide services and educational opportunities, much as the unit did in their villages in France. It also provided an outlet for the talents of educated women at a time when work outside the home was not yet the norm for women of means. Many of the real members of the unit had a settlement house background. There is a score of books on the settlement house movement, including Domenica Barbuto's American Settlement Houses and Progressive Social Reform, and Harry Krause's The Settlement House Movement in New York City, 1886 to 1914. Because there were so few secondary sources, I relied very heavily on the Smith unit's own letters, trying, when necessary, to make allowances for unreliable narration and to cross-reference with other contemporary accounts whenever possible. The members of the Smith unit, I noticed, had a tendency to downplay the danger to themselves when writing home, something that was highlighted when I compared accounts of being bombed out of the hospital in Beauvais by, on the one hand, the Smith unit, and on the other, an American nurse, not a smithy. For anyone wanting to hear the voices of the members of the Smith College Relief Unit, I highly recommend checking out the 1917 and 1918 issues of the Smith Alumni Quarterly, which are sprinkled with letters written home by unit members. I was deeply amused reading their private letters to find them scolding family members for sending in their letters to the alumni rag, and for heaven's sake, these were for private consumption only. Apparently, some letter recipients didn't listen, because you can find excerpts of their letters included in the alumni magazine straight through 1918. These issues are freely available online through the Smith Alumni Quarterly Archives. You can also find a compilation of letters, including some gems not included in the Alumni Quarterly, in a 1968 pamphlet by Louise Elliott Dalby called An Irrepressible Crew, the Smith College Relief Unit. You can find glancing references to the Smith Unit in books such as Dorothy and Carl Schneider's Into the Breach, American Women Overseas in World War I, and Ed Klukowski and Libby Klukowski's lively, and sometimes laugh-out-loud funny, Eyewitnesses to the Great War, American Writers, Reporters, Volunteers, and Soldiers in France, 1914 to 1918, as well as a few other places. But there has not yet been a monograph written entirely about the Smith College Relief Unit, an omission that Professor Jennifer Hall Witt of Smith College is in the process of remedying. In the meantime, for those wishing to know more about the real Smith College Relief Unit, as I hope you do, you can find a reader's guide on my website, www.laurenwillig.com, which contains pictures, maps, and other items of interest. I hope you find the Smithies who went to war as fascinating and inspiring as I do. This is Julia Whalen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Band of Sisters, a novel by Lauren Willig, presented by William Morrow and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright 2021 by Lauren Willig. Production copyright 2021 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.